Welcome to the fifth episode of the Gym 7 Podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us again. Now, we talk all the time in the coffee industry about washed coffees, and yet it's a really important part of the process that we don't really understand that well. But to get more into it, today I'm going to be talking to Peter Giuliano from Counterculture Coffee, and we're going to run a little bit longer than usual, but I promise you right now, it is absolutely worth it. So, hope you enjoy. Do you want to dive straight in?
Sure.
All right. Well, it's been kind of podcast week for you this week, I guess.
I suppose that's right.
The Portafilter podcast, which I was going to give a lot more love to until they said it sounded like James Bond and Mr. Bean. So, I don't know how I feel about that Portafilter podcast. So anyway, we scheduled this one to talk specifically about fermentation.
Yes.
And before we get into that, I always feel like I have a strong urge to kind of preface these kind of conversations with talking about how we as an industry talk about processing coffee, because I feel like we're a little bit deceitful about processing coffee, because we tend to talk about how the process affects flavor, mm-hmm. as if the process was done with the purpose of creating that flavor.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think a lot of people end up presuming that the choices that producers are making are down to what they want to achieve in the cup, I mean, you'll have a lot more experience of this than me, but
yeah,
that's very rarely the case.
Yeah. No, yeah. And but I think the misunderstanding goes the other way too. I think this is a perfect example of each side of that particular chain not really knowing what the other one is talking about. Because you're absolutely right. Most coffee consumer type people, whether they be roasters or baristas or whatever, think that processing is some sort of intentional act to try to create flavor. And it was not invented that way. You're exactly right. Producers, on the other hand, don't think of it as a way to create. They think of it in a purely mechanical sense.
Yeah.
And oftentimes don't think of it as being a way to create flavor, even as a secondary thing. It's purely mechanical, often from a producer standpoint, and purely, which is a mistake, because it's not purely mechanical. It does have an impact on the flavor.
Sure.
But their intention is to remove the mucilage or whatever, process the coffee in the least risky way possible with the least amount of inputs possible. And the consumer doesn't think about that. I agree with you completely.
So you've been doing some experiments.
Right. Well, I think the idea is to try to bridge that gap a little bit, you know, to sort of impose or acknowledge the idea that processing has an impact on coffee flavor, mm-hmm. And then bring some understanding of that to the producing end. Because look, using the tired analogy of wine, you know, the intention of fermenting wine originally wasn't to create any of the flavors that we now know, that we now recognize in a well-made wine. The original intention of making wine is to create alcohol.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's the level of practicality that coffee processing is at right now. It's about minimizing the risk of off flavors and stabilizing the coffee as quickly as possible after it's been picked.
Yeah.
But in the case of washed coffee, let's talk about fermentation. So we know that when coffee is picked and then depulped, meaning the skin is taken off, and then it's covered with this sticky mucilage, then the tradition and this thing that was invented in Costa Rica in the late 19th century is that if you let it sit for some period of time, that mucilage magically becomes soluble in water and can be washed away.
Yep.
That process wasn't clearly understood at first, obviously, by the people that did it. They just did it. They knew it happened and they used it. And it's still not understood by most people who work in coffee today. We use this word fermentation, which just means to let it sit for a while. It doesn't really have a specific scientific meaning or even a specific cultural meaning means, you know, fermentation is when you let something, some food sit for a while and something happens to it. So there's no clarity among the coffee industry about exactly why that happens. People know that it has to do with temperature, that it's temperature dependent. In cold places, it happens more slowly than it happens in warm places. And they know that if it is done in the wrong environment, or if it goes on too long, that it can bring a bad flavor to coffee. But that's kind of the limit to what most coffee people, even longtime professionals, know about it. And there's this persistent belief that pectin has something to do with it, you know, because pectin is this material in fruits, and it holds fruits together. And if you use pectase, which is an enzyme that breaks down pectin, most fruits come apart. And they figure, well, it must have something to do with pectase, and that's about where it ends.
But I mean, that's most of mucilage is pectin, though, right? Like that's really what it's made up of. And just kind of going back before we get into experimental stuff, I still feel like it's really not clear, because processing is one of those things that like most people have read about several times, mm-hmm. before they've gone to see it live.
Right.
And when you see it live, it's nothing like you thought it was going to be.
Right.
I don't think anyone has been unsurprised by seeing that process for the first time.
Absolutely.
And I think also we talk about, you know, washed coffees or anything else, but there's quite a huge range of technique covered in that banner. Is that, you know, I would say that it's not a particularly fixed technique of washing coffee.
No, that's right. It's totally unstandardized.
And, you know, this, so saying washing coffee includes whether we're talking about kind of covered or uncovered open air fermentation before you know it goes anywhere near water. That doesn't always happen. That sometimes happens, and you know, it feels like there's a lot in there that could do with some better definitions for me. Like,
yeah,
we could break those stages down a little bit more and understand when people are skipping a stage, mm-hmm. whether they're doing an open air fermentation or not.
Right.
Because am I right in that sometimes there's no open air fermentation? It's fermented, covered or in water sometimes.
Right.
And
absolutely.
That's a separate sort of stage to washing off the fermented and broken down pectin.
Right.
So, you know, it's a term that we use as a, you know, in the same way that we, you know, use a pulp natural, which is a much more specific process.
Right.
We would go, it's a wash coffee. And
yep.
it's a pretty terrible descriptor of what that process is.
Yeah. Well, that you've pretty much totally accurately described my personal journey. You know, I read about coffee fermentation, washing in a book before I ever did anything, you know, and said, this is how washed coffee is processed. And it described being underwater and stuff. And then when I finally went to Origin and it wasn't underwater, in fact, there wasn't much water used in the process until the actual washing off of the mucilage, I was confused by it. And then my experience, I'm sure your experience is the same way, as you go from place to place to place, you realize there's radical differences. In El Salvador, they will ferment for 6 or 8 hours. And in Kenya, they might ferment for 72.
And so El Salvador, cherries picked,
right.
Pulped. And then are we talking, when you say fermentation, are we talking just coffee sat in a fermentation tank with a little
right.
water, a lot of water, open air? What's going on here?
Like open air.
Open
the,
air.
Yeah. And kind of the standard now Latin American process, which apparently wasn't the process like in the 60s.
Okay.
Apparently this is the most one that is most recognizable today in Latin America, is you depulp the coffee in the evening, you take the skin off in the evening, you put it in some kind of a tank, most commonly made of concrete, and you leave it. And you walk away. And the coffee sits there in the fermentation tank, open with the mucilage there, and just sits there for overnight, which is what mostly they do all throughout Latin America. It's like overnight.
Okay.
The next day, at some point, when it's done, and most farmers will or processors will feel it with their hands mm-hmm. and make a decision about whether it's ready or not to be washed based on the way it feels. But that diagnostic isn't perfect either. Everybody has a different point at which they feel like done is.
Okay, so when you're rubbing this, you're looking for a kind of squeaky parchment.
Yeah, well, some people, processors, want it to be really, like they say, like a wet shingle. It rubs and it's quite rough.
Okay.
Other times some processors want it to just feel somewhat less slimy than it did when it started. So they're terminating at different points depending on their own local tradition.
Which is riskier?
Objectively, it would depend on how dry the environment is. So, for example, in El Salvador, my observation is that they tend to leave a lot more mucilage on when they move it if it hasn't fermented completely when you wash it, some mucilage still remains on the coffee.
Okay.
They can get away with that in El Salvador because they're drying in environments that are so hot and so dry that that's okay. And so there's no risk of it getting moldy. Yep. In a cooler environment, less dry environment, leaving that mucilage on might be riskier.
Okay.
And now, but then the converse can be true as well. If you let it ferment until the mucilage is totally dissolved, then that will stretch out the fermentation. It may stretch it out over the course of a couple of days, which may feel riskier to a producer. Gotcha. So if you under-ferment it, that feels risky because it can mold because it doesn't dry quickly enough. If you over-ferment it, that feels risky because it may develop those over-fermented flavors that include a yogurt or onion or kind of dumpster juice kind of characteristic. So everybody is shooting to be somewhere in between those two.
Yeah.
And that's highly local and highly individual. But in Latin America, it's almost universally no water covering it. You take the skin off, you put it in the fermentation tank, you let it ferment. Overnight, you wash it, you bring it to the drying area, and that's the process.
And the washing after that is quite a quick process?
Yes, it can be, and it depends on how much water is available and what the equipment they have is. I've seen it take a few minutes. I've seen it take, you know, a half an hour.
Gotcha.
Depending on how thorough they want to wash it.
So in contrast to that, we're talking about, you mentioned Kenya.
Yes. So in Kenya, so that to me, experiencing Latin America, that's what washed coffee was. That's what the washed coffee process was. Mm-hmm. I got to Kenya and I said, okay, so here's where you ferment the coffee overnight. And they said, yes, except we don't ferment it overnight. We ferment it for days. Now, if anybody in Latin America ever heard that, they would think, that's insane. You can't ferment coffee for more than a day. It will become over-fermented. But that's commonplace in Kenya. And they're talking about fermentation times of 48 or 72 hours. You know, these long fermentation times, open to the air, just exactly the same way as they're fermenting in Latin America.
Okay.
But except for a much longer period, and then washing the coffee. And then also in Kenya, there's a kind of a post-washing soak that they will tend to do and soak the coffee after washing it for a period of 24 hours before then drying it.
And I'm jumping ahead already, but why the second soak?
Well, apparently originally it was purely functional to sort of hold coffee in a stable way until there was enough room on the drying tables to dry the coffee. So it was sort of, you know, you just cover it with water and then it's okay and you can leave it be. But at some point it just became part of the process. And, you know, most processors will have some sort of rationale. You know, it helps the quality to condition it in this soaking tank for 24 hours beforehand. There's a general belief that process improves quality somehow generally, but there's not a lot of agreement on what the what the actual function is.
Yeah.
Then I get to Yirgacheffe, Ethiopia, and they are also fermenting for a very long time, except they're fermenting underwater rather than in the open air like they do in Latin America and in Kenya. Mm-hmm. So there's another kind of variation where the coffee is being fermented underwater. In Burundi, they seem to use a combination of both, fermenting first open air, and then moving it to a place where they'll ferment it for a while underwater, then wash the coffee, then perhaps soak it again, perhaps not.
Okay.
So you've got all these different kind of variables and I'm talking about it like it's uniform. And of course, some coffee buyer, I'm sure, will correct me and say, no, I've seen underwater fermentation in Guatemala. Yes, that's true. These subtle variations happen everywhere, and it's not perfectly uniform anywhere, but I'm talking about in generalities here.
Yep.
In general, in Latin America, the process is, as I described, a short fermentation process followed by washing and drying. In Kenya, a longer fermentation with no water, then washing and drying and soaking. And in Ethiopia, underwater fermentation followed by washing and drying and soaking.
Gotcha. So how much, as the world inevitably gets smaller, how much are we seeing a kind of cross-pollination of technique from country to country?
It's starting to happen quite a bit. And one of the things that I've noticed is, like in Kenya, as people from Latin America have started to sort of be around in Kenya, I've noticed that you start to hear processors in Kenya start to say, well, wait a second, maybe we don't need to ferment this long period. Mm. And that's a little bit alarming to me because as a – look, I was a beer brewer for a while, and I knew, I'm still an active bread maker and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. All the, those of us that eat and drink know, get to recognize fermentation byproducts. And in these coffees, particularly Kenyan and Ethiopian ones, I feel like I recognize flavors that remind me of fermentation byproducts, like you might taste in cheese or beer or wine or soy sauce or something like that.
Okay.
And so once they start, my reaction to hearing processors in Kenya start to think, well, maybe they don't ferment so long in Latin America, so maybe we don't need to either. My reaction to that was somewhat alarmed. And so that's starting to happen. At the same time, we wanted to kind of cross-pollinate the other way and start to do experimentation with African processing techniques in Latin America.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of cross-pollination that I've been a part of. But in general, it's still at the very, very, very open, or at the very, very beginnings of that kind of cross-pollination, I would say.
There's just one tiny little interesting thing to throw in that it's a friend of mine who's a wine writer and introduced the idea to me that it might be worth considering yeasts, sort of bacterial sort of and yeasts kind of in the air, mm-hmm. as part of terroir.
Right.
Obviously, this was coming from a wine standpoint, but then suddenly my brain is thinking about, open air fermentation in coffee. And we don't really understand what's going on there, or we don't really know a great deal about the interaction with the environment happening there. I hope that's fair to say.
No, that's exactly right. And that was the same thing that sort of, once I started, thinking about the fermentation stage, I thought the same thing, because we know that that's true in wine and in beer. The Belgian ales that are so famous and that everybody's crazy about, many of those are fermented open in Belgium, and they're reliant on wild strains of yeast that just inhabit these specific microclimates in Belgium, and they're exactly perfect for developing that style of beer. We know that when you do open fermentation, as they do everywhere, this fermentation is not controlled anywhere. So we know that whatever is wild, whatever wild micro microbes are in the air in that environment, they are at least present in the fermentation tank during the fermentation. Mm-hmm. And it's very likely, and some of the little science that's out there seems to indicate that those microbes are actually very active in the fermentation process itself. So and then the question is what is the flavor contribution of those microbes? And just as you say, how much of that flavor, the microbiological flavor, is contributing to the terroir of the coffee?
Yeah.
Is that part of the reason that Kenyan coffee tastes different than Ethiopian coffee?
Sure.
Is it because of the microbes that are in the fermentation tank? And so that's a question that's been haunting me for the last decade, really.
Well, you kind of wonder if we're going to get to the place like big commercial wine where you can order yeasts based on how much black cherry you want the wine to present.
Right.
Like, you know, I like the natural wine movement in contrast to this. So it's not something I'm ever looking for coffee to get involved in. But you kind of wonder how possible that is. And, you know, if it's that dramatic and explicit in wine, is it at least, you know, a fraction of that in coffee? And that would be interesting.
Well, and it's exactly that curiosity that drove, actually Aida Baye from El Salvador was visiting San Francisco, and we went to do an tasting event together in the Napa Valley, and we were driving around the Napa Valley and we were having this conversation. And we decided on that trip to why not try some experiments in coffee. And so 6 months later, I was down in El Salvador, and I'd brought with me some commercial yeasts, just as you described. And these are yeasts and other microbes basically that have been cultivated for use in wine and beer making. So now yeasts are wild. About 70 or 80% of the microflora that's in the air is yeasts of one kind or another.
Okay.
So and then there are certain ones that they've just kind of cultivated over time and that are useful for winemaking and beer making. So what I did was I got some commercial yeasts, one that was a cultivated strain that was associated with the Bordeaux region in France. Mm-hmm. Another one that was a Belgian yeast strain, actually two Belgian yeast strains that would be used in making Belgian beer. I got some Brettanomyces, which are not a yeast. They're a bacterium that is one of the flavor that creates some of the flavor characteristics in sour ales and lambics.
Yeah.
That are part of beer making, and some malolactic bacteria. Malolactic bacteria are ones that are used in winemaking to create certain flavors, particularly turning malic acid into lactic acid, and they're the ones that create buttery Chardonnays, those buttery flavors in Chardonnay. So I went down to El Salvador armed with these yeast samples and what we did is we inoculated fermentation tanks with them. Not really fermentation tanks. We used 5 gallon buckets filled with coffee covered in mucilage and put those yeast cultures in the fermentation in with the fermenting coffee to see how those microbes would impact the flavor of the coffee.
Sure.
Now the intention, I think a lot of people would naturally jump to the conclusion of, oh my God, you're making wine flavored, you know, coffee.
Sure.
And that's not the intention at all. The intention really is to just see what manipulating the the microbial spectrum of the fermentation tank does to coffee flavor.
Yeah.
And the thing that I'm really curious about is what the impact will be, how large the impact will be.
I'm curious, just did you have a control sample running in terms of rate of fermentation, just to sort of see whether, because I would guess that if you're adding, your concentrations are going to be unusually high compared to what nature might offer.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
If you saw any kind of acceleration or any kind of change due to those concentrations.
Yeah. Well, it was. Yeah, we were running a control at the same time, and so what we wound up doing was we were doing one of the things that we wanted to do with Aedes coffee anyway is do a micro lot in the Ethiopian Yirgacheffe style of processing. So that's okay. Underwater fermentation, and we decided to ferment it for 48 hours underwater. Okay.
Yeah.
So at the same time as we were doing that, we were also underwater in these 5-gallon buckets, doing all of those ones that I just described: the Bordeaux yeast, the Belgian yeasts, the Brettanomyces, etc. And it was interesting to see how they. And they were all covered with water because water seemed, you know, water is a good substrate for these things to act in. And it sort of winds up reminding you of a 5-gallon fermenting batch of beer or wine or something.
Did they smell different?
They did. They smelled radically different. And the water tasted quite different in each of the samples. So the natural sample, and in other words, the one that was just using whatever ambient bacteria microbes, you know, in the fermentation style, in the Ethiopian fermentation style, that water got sort of more, well, first of all, you could see after about 24 hours, you start to see bubbles, carbon dioxide bubbles kind of coming up.
Yep.
It looks sort of gently carbonated, you know, and there's a little bit of foam that emerges on the top, and that water starts to taste a little bit tangy.
Yeah.
Now that was what was happening in El Salvador. In Ethiopia, I've always noticed that the water, when the coffee is fermenting like that, tastes powerfully tangy, almost like sparkling lemonade with a little bit of an alcohol kick.
Is it good?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's quite delicious. I think it would remind most people of a kind of a watered down kombucha. yeah. So anyway, I like it. I think it's good. I think probably most people would like it. It sort of dries out the natural sweetness of this thing. Mm. So now in the red wine fermentation, by the next day it was foaming up significantly like a beer fermentation or a wine fermentation would.
Yeah.
So it was clearly a lot more yeast it smelled like beer. It smelled like brewing beer does, you know, that sort of power, that yeasty kind of thing. And all of the yeast fermentations had that characteristic. The Belgian ones were slightly more sour but they were all very powerful. The Brettanomyces didn't act very active, although you could see colonies of the bacteria after about 24 hours start to accumulate at the top. They say flocculate. They flocculate at the top.
Okay.
And then that liquid got very, very powerfully sour. And that one actually reminded me the most of the flavors I tasted in Ethiopia. So they all acted differently. The yeast fermentations would dissolve the mucilage faster than the other ones. So there seemed to be some action that the yeasts were doing that were dissolving the mucilage faster than in the other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And this supports some of the theories that they've done some studies and they've concluded from these studies that yeast activity is important in the mucilage degradation either because the yeasts are secreting pectase enzymes that are dissolving the pectin,
or because
that creation of those acids that we taste as acidity, that the yeasts and other microbes secrete, dissolve the sort of act on the cell walls and cause them to rupture, along with osmotic pressure from their sugar consumption. So the mechanics of this are definitely foggy. There are some competing theories, and I haven't been convinced of any one theory yet.
Sure. I'm curious. I don't know enough about this stuff, so you can probably shoot me down straight away. Is there any way that, I mean, pectin is essentially a long-chain sugar. Mm-hmm. Is there any way, or is there any chance that it's being used as fuel or food as well?
I think that's a possibility. I don't know enough about yeast metabolism to know if there's any yeasts that can metabolize pectin. And that's a great question. I think this is a place where microbiologists would be welcome. And, you know, this is a fair place to point out that I am definitely out of my depth from a microbiology place. I'm coming as a tinkerer at this point. This isn't science. This is playing around. Yeah.
It's always, we're going to end up talking about the geekery again if we're not careful, because it's
That's right.
What the geekery should be all about
yes.
for me. So anyway,
exactly.
We could get right into that, but I want to stick to fermentation for now.
Right.
So that was a few weeks ago.
Right.
And that coffee has been drying since, pretty much?
It's been drying, yes, and we haven't tasted any yet. But what was interesting is by the time we washed the coffee, all of the fermentation waters tasted very, very different from one another. Some of them had high levels of alcohol that you could taste. Others had high levels of acetic and other acids that you could taste. Mm-hmm. So they all tasted different. But by the time we washed all of the coffees, I couldn't perceive any strong aromatic characteristics in the washed coffee.
Gotcha.
So that was interesting to me. That was the first most interesting thing to me is that even though the fermentation water was strongly flavored, it didn't seem to have a significant effect on the aromatics of the parchment coffee.
And I mean, I haven't smelt enough parchment coffee in my life to use it as any sort of indicator. And I'm curious if it is. I mean, have you generally seen any correlation between how a parchment coffee smells and what you get at the end? Like, is there a smell you're looking for that's indicating everything has gone okay here?
Yeah, my practice as a coffee buyer has always been to smell wet parchment or drying parchment and look for any smell that may remind me of garbage or vinegar, which would indicate over fermentation. I think that's what coffee buyers I think are doing when they do that coffee buyer move of going to the drying patio and get up and smell. Anyway, that's what I've always done. And indeed, I've found lots of coffee that have off smells, you know. So there was none of those off smells. So really what you're looking for is just a sweet, neutral smell.
Yeah.
Something like hay or wet hay or something like that. And that's exactly what all of these coffees smelled like.
Hmm. And which farm was this done on? Where was the coffee picked from?
It was all picked from Finca Mauritania, one of Aida's four farms. Yeah. And so this is all coffee that I was intending to buy anyway, and Aida just graciously indulged. And she's an experimental
sure.
person herself. So we spent a good week fooling around with these things, and I'm looking forward to hearing the results. I've been sort of leaking bits of this on the internet, and it seems like people are interested in this phenomenon and what the outcomes will be.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So and it's all Bourbon there, right?
Right. All Bourbon variety on that farm. So and it's a good control. It's all picked on the same day and all that stuff.
And how much are you obsessing over the details along the way? Are you going to get a chance to compare moisture contents and just see, you know, did they dry uniformly? Or do they all dry to the same level? Coffee is, because there's no, like, I figure this for everything. There's no clear-cut answer. There's no direct cause and effect in coffee because there's too much going on.
This is the kind of stuff that Rick calls, Rick Reinhart, the executive director of the SCA, calls bad little science, you know? It's our tendency to think that this is actually an experiment, and it's not. We're not controlling enough, and I'm not collecting enough data to have it be real science. We're not planning on doing real strict monitoring of drying percentages and stuff like that.
Sure.
The other thing that happened is, unfortunately, during this whole thing, there was a couple of random rainstorms that had Aida and me out in the middle of the night, soaking wet, trying to cover up our experiments because it was raining when it shouldn't have been.
Sure.
So it's not the super ideal thing. It's a little bit of, you know, country field science, but
think it has the potential to build excitement and interest and momentum behind, you know, people wanting to see it done more, you know, rigorously or formally, I guess. Is the way. So, you know, while it's easy to pick it to pieces as bad science, it still doesn't mean it's an experiment. You know, it's not an experiment that should be done.
Right.
It's, if it was fun and entertaining and ultimately turns out to be interesting and educational.
Right.
I don't see anything wrong with that. I don't think it should be published in a journal,
right.
But no one's claiming that.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, I do want to use that as a caveat, because I think that I think our whatever results we get will be interesting but not conclusive. You know.
Sure.
I think there is a tendency to have one for people, and this is along the coffee chain, you know, whether it's in an espresso machine or at doing processing work, to have a good result from one little experiment and think that that's the answer always. And I know that that's not going to be our conclusion here, but it will definitely be interesting. At the same time, Aida is also doing experiments using the Kenyan process, especially for her Kilimanjaro coffee, with the Ethiopian process that we're doing for Mauritania. And that started last year, actually. And so she's continuing that as well. So there's lots of these cool little experiments happening.
Because I think in terms of other experiments going back, I think the first time, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Dr. Kim Schilling popped up on my radar was a Rwandan coffee washing experiment, right?
That's right. And what he was trying to do then was, and actually this emerged from a conversation that Tim and Jeff Watts and I had in Rwanda, because what he was curious, you know, he was kind of rebuilding building the Rwandan processing thing, and he was obviously very curious to know what was right, whether the Latin American short fermentation was better than the Kenyan long fermentation in the Rwandan context. And so that was the very first, and so we were able to actually isolate a specific washing station and use that just to do this experiment. So Counterculture and Intelligentsia and Tim collaborated on this, and it was actually a multi-year experiment, first with fermentation times, also with the cherry, holding cherry before pulping, what the impact on quality that was.
Okay.
Some experiments with demucilaging machines and whether what impact those had or didn't have on coffee processing in Rwanda, and those studies actually were published, Tim and the Spread Project. Which evolved from the Pearl Project, published those studies, because he actually designed them. He's an agronomist, so he was able to design them as legitimate scientific experiments, and they were the results were evaluated by statisticians and everything. So that stuff was processed, yeah. And those experiments are what led directly to the geekery. Which is cool.
All right, I have two more topics I want to talk to you about real quick.
Sure.
Just because I'm already breaking the rules about how long these should be, but I think it's too interesting to skip ahead.
Okay.
One, something you said really early on, it's a bit of a random question, but for people who do want to read more, what are your like top three coffee books?
Ooh, that's a great question. You know, I puzzle over that a lot because this book that I read early in my coffee career has now been lost to me, and it was a two volume set by you might know about this by a German publisher, and it comes in two volumes. One's called Coffee Processing and one's called Coffee Production.
Is this Bernard Rothfuss?
This is the Rothfuss book, exactly.
Okay, I have one of them.
Okay. And that was I still think, although I haven't read it in a long time, my copy was unfortunately stolen from me, but I think that's a interesting and very sort of, dynamic book, you know. Okay. I still think, Kevin Knox's Coffee Basics always has an mm-hmm. important place in my heart. That was an important early fundamental coffee book to me. And those are kind of the important ones as far as coffee books go.
Yep.
I enjoy reading papers, scientific papers that have been published. That's really where I get most of my information these days. Sort of plumbing the depths of the ASIC website, which is an association of coffee researchers and various academic publications.
Okay, all right. There's one more thing I need to talk to you about.
Sure.
It's something that I have come so close to writing a blog post about, but every time I do it, I feel like I'm stealing from you.
I know what you're going to say.
You do, don't you? Yes. I'm we need to settle. Variety right. versus varietal.
Right. It's so funny. I had this conversation with somebody yesterday. Here's what I discovered. I'm a little bit of a grammarian and at one point I wanted to find out what was the right term. You know, when we talk about Bourbon or Tipica or whatever, just like when we talk about Merlot or Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Noir, what is the right term? Because agronomists use all sorts of terms. They use variety. Sometimes they use land race. Where does the word hybrid fit in? Heirloom, all these different things. So I did some research, and what I discovered is the most standard term is botanical variety.
Okay.
So there's a species, and then anything below that, in the kind of taxonomic order, is a variety of a species, and that's the word that botanists use. They say Bourbon is a variety of coffee.
Okay, so when we're talking about all Bourbon or all Tipica, we should use variety.
Yes, that's the right term to use. Now, when they did this thing in wine where they decided to try to sell wine based on its variety, right? Mm-hmm. So they said, we have an idea. Rather than sell it as where it's from, like Burgundy, we'll sell coffee we'll sell wine according to what variety it is that we made the wine out of, and so we will sell it varietally.
Yes.
So we will sell it as a varietal wine. So in that case, you're saying you're using varietal as a description of the wine. Just as in the same way that you'd use societal you might say societal issue, where the noun is issue.
Yes.
But if you're using society as a noun, then you say society. You would never say societal as a noun. So, but unfortunately, the word varietal got used and adopted as a noun in the wine world. And so now, normally, they'll talk about, when they talk about Cabernet Sauvignon, they talk about it as a varietal, even if they're talking about the grapes.
Yep.
So to tell you the truth, James, I'm conflicted about it. On the one hand, I know that calling it variety is the right thing to do. But you know, we've talked about this. Varietal has become so entrenched. You know, I hate to go around correcting people all the time. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm open to language being a malleable, flexible, ever-changing thing, and its goal is not to, you know, adhere to strict rules, but to communicate something from one person to another. And I figure that, you know, if I say varietal, you know what I mean. It's an effective communicating word.
Right.
But, you know, it's you know, listen to me talk. I would rather use the right term for the right thing. And, you know, I think it's important if we do want to, you know, keep, and I think we do, promoting traceable coffees where we can use varietal properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that we almost need to use it properly to make a point that we can use it properly in coffee.
Right. Well, I think that'll be important once people do what I think is very interesting, which is sell coffee according to its variety, in which case that will be a varietal coffee.
I used to get quite excited about that idea until I began to understand the lack of genetic diversity in most cultivars.
Yeah.
Sneak another one in there.
Yeah.
you know, that if I put a cup of coffee down in front of you, if I put two cups in front of you, and I said one of them is Typica.
Right.
And one of them is, I don't know, say Cattura.
Right.
How confident would you be?
Right, right. Not at all.
That you could taste through and go, okay, that's this and this is that.
Right, right.
Which I think you can maybe do a little bit more easily with some grape varieties.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I'd love to have a wine expert and have this conversation with them. I suspect, I mean, you know, I've tasted, you know, a wine that tasted very Pinot Noir-y to me. Mm-hmm. But then I've tasted other Pinot Noirs that didn't taste especially Pinot Noir-y at all, that may not be able to be distinguishable from a Cabernet. So I don't know. What I do know, though, about varieties is that I'm certain that we can tell, especially under the right circumstances, an Ethiopian variety, say Geisha or, you know, Wolesho or one of the Ethiopian varieties, apart from a Typica. So
yes,
there, you know, that there's something there, but you're right. I mean, it would be a little bit silly, you know, to sell a Bourbon and a Cattura as different when they're genetically almost identical.
And, you know, I'm sure there would be taste differences, but again, it's just so hard to absolutely feel confident that, you know, what you were saying is caused by what we're promoting.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for me, it would be amazing to see more varieties, you know, developed and grown and spreading in coffee that have sufficient characteristic. And I mean, if you look how completely insane the industry went about Geisha.
Right.
Like the whole industry just went completely insane in many ways because you could taste the variety.
Right. Absolutely.
And we, you know, producers and buyers and, you know, consumers and roasters just lost it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it would be great to see that happen more and more. And, you know, maybe you could say with Pacamaras.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, that there's something there. But the list runs pretty short pretty quickly.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I agree with you. And you know, I toy with the ideas, I'm sure you do, of what it would be like. I think there are certain heirloom. Another thing, which is like a strictly traditional thing. I'm very interested in heirloom bean varieties.
Okay.
Which look tremendously different. There's a farm that I'm crazy about in California called Rancho Gordo that sells all these different heirloom varieties of beans. Okay. So I don't know. I've never looked into the genetics of it, but and I don't know how diverse or non-diverse these genes are. But they look very different from each other, and they taste quite different from each other. Now, they're two individual ones may not taste very different from each other, but as a broad spectrum, they do. And it's just fun to explore these different varieties of beans, many of which were grown commonly in the United States 100 years ago, but have fallen out of fashion.
Huh.
That's a cool thing to do, you know, I think. It's not necessarily strictly limited to flavor, but it touches on history and appearance and tradition and stuff like that, you know? So the Bourbon, I believe the Bourbon thing in El Salvador is, not only is it one of the keys to the quality of El Salvadoran coffee, but it also is an interesting story and a good tradition. You know, Salvador has a unique relationship with this Salvadoran Bourbon variety that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like Mundo Nuevo is about Brazil, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was able to... Just one thing before we leave this, I went to Inteligencia works with this farm in Colombia called Santuario.
Yes,
and the farmer has all these different varieties that he inherited from a collection, Inteligencia at their Pasadena store about 6 months ago held a tasting of all these different varieties grown on this farm, and it was an eye-opening experience for me, even as a coffee buyer for a long time. I mean, Jeff and I were tasting these coffees, and he'd already tasted them, obviously, and it was like, wow, there is incredible things to be had there.
Sure.
So I was go ahead.
I was deeply envious watching that from a very long way away.
Yeah.
Jeff had promised me, and I'm going to find a way to get him back. He'd promised me some eugenoides.
Uh-huh.
Just as a kind of crazy... that's a species though, right? Isn't it?
Well, yes, I think it was. I think eugenoides is a species, and it apparently is the species that has some sort of heritage in the SL28. It's somewhere in the SL28, and it certainly tasted that way at that cupping. It was definitely interesting. It definitely had that black currant characteristic that we associate with SL28. So that was probably the most eye opening part of that whole experience.
That's very good. What's the species that Yucas talks about again? As being better than Arabica? I want to say it's Stenophylla, but maybe that's wrong.
It might be. That's a great question. I don't have Euchers here, which is, you can't talk about coffee books, by the way, without talking about Euchers. But I think it was Stenophylla. If it wasn't, might it have been Liberica that he was talking about?
No, it was definitely something that's not, I haven't seen or had a chance to taste ever, and I have no idea if it's still grown anywhere.
Okay, I think that's Stenophylla then. I think you're right.
Huh. Damn it. I'm sure there's somewhere there's a variety garden with a tree somewhere.
Yeah,
I hope.
I'm sure there is.
I hope. All right. Well, if it's okay with you, I think I'm going to wrap this one up here. This was
absolutely
amazing and very interesting for me. So thank you so much for this, Peter. I had a great time.
Thank you. I did too. It was nice talking to you as always.
All right. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.